I call the House Energy Committee meeting to order. Today is February 5th, thanks to the slides up there, and it is 1:10 p.m. Members present are Representative Kopp, Representative Costello, Representative Edgman, Co-Chair Holland, and myself, Co-Chair Donna Mears. We have a quorum to conduct business, but today we have presentations. I'd like to remind members and staff to please turn off your phones. If you need to pass a note to anyone, please see my aide, Griffin Plush. I'd also like to thank Representative Holland's aide, Tim Truer, for being here today. Before we get started, I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Cheryl Cole, and Doug Bridges from the Juno LIO for technical support. So today's agenda, we will be hearing presentations from four rural electric utility CEOs about the challenges and opportunities they face in providing power to communities. After everyone's given their presentations, we'll have everyone join us at the table for a panel discussion. So be mindful when you're considering your questions so that we've got time for four of them and a discussion. I am grateful that we're taking advantage of the Alaska Power Association conference in Juneau this week. And these are folks that don't necessarily fly down to Juneau quite so often. So I'm very grateful that you're taking the time to be here with us today and share in person your systems and the work that you're doing. So we have Bill Stamm from the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. Thanks for joining us again. Tom Atkinson from Kotzebue Electric Association, who has previously joined us on the phone, but in person here today. Clay Copland from Cordova Electric Cooperative and Will Cheney from Nooshigat Cooperative. So first up, we'll start with Bill Stamm. Bill is the CEO of the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. Please come to the table, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Thank you. I'm Bill Stamm, President and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. I'd like to thank Co-Chair Mears and Co-Chair Holland, the rest of the committee members, for having us come down, give our perspective on providing power in rural Alaska. Alaska Village Electric Cooperative is a member-owned cooperative, much like my compatriots here. We're owned by the members we serve, and AVEC is a little bit different than most cooperatives. We serve 58 rural communities around Alaska, mostly on the in western Alaska, but we also do serve Yakutat in southeast, Old Harbor down on Kodiak Island, and Minto, which is about a three-hour drive north of Fairbanks. Minto is the only system that we serve that's on the road system. Everything else that we serve, materials, people, everything that we do is delivered by barge or by plane. These next few slides are just visual entertainment. When a person from AVEC is dispatched to go to one of our communities, they usually are flying out of Anchorage and they take a jet and they land in a hub community, Kotzebue, Nome, Bethel, those sorts of places. Then they get on a smaller plane, they transport all their gear, and then they fly for another hour or so over the wilds of Alaska, where it is beautiful and sometimes frightening, the things you see out there. But I just provided those slides to impress upon folks that there's not a whole lot of infrastructure between points A and point B. When you get to a community, looking out the window, this is looking at the community of Savunga, which is on the north side of St. Lawrence Island. It faces the Bering Sea. And you can see below the plain, the Bering Sea is just about frozen. There's some open water there. There's some land fast ice against the coast, and the community is right on the edge of the island. If we zoom into that community, it is a typical rural community, very compact in the area that they're at. The communities themselves are spread out, but once you get to where the resources are, usually the communities are fairly compact. It's a small rural community. Some of the things that you can see in this drawing or in this picture, the airstrip, that is the lifeblood or connection to the outside world. There is, I don't know if I can actually use my mouse. If that shows up, probably not. Okay. In the lower left, there's a power plant and tank farm, water plant. There's houses spread out the community. There's a clinic. There's a store. There's a city office. The large building in the upper right is the K-12 school. And if you look a little farther right, you'll see two wind turbines. So we installed wind generation in Savunga somewhere around 2010, I believe. And it's been providing some diesel displacement in that community since then. But that's it. Not a lot of industrial loads in a community, typically. Savunga is a community of about 800 people, I believe. And if you are looking at them on this graphic, they're about three quarters of the way up the page. So they've got kilowatt hour sales of about 2 million kilowatt hours per year. What this graphic shows is the annual power sales from our 46 power plants. So we only have 46 power plants serving the 58 communities. Some of our communities are tied together with distribution lines. Those lines are at a distribution voltage, not the large infrastructure towers that you might see in transmission, just very similar to what you might see outside your bedroom window. Power poles with power lines on them. Some of those power poles are mounted onto driven steel piles because of the soil conditions between communities. But I've got two communities highlighted here, Wales and St. Mary's. I've got some anecdotal stories to share with those, and that's a reminder to myself, but also to provide some perspective on the size of the communities that we serve. You can see that there is a large bar to the very right side of that graphic, and that is the community of Bethel. AVEC acquired the Bethel utility in 2014. It is head and shoulders larger than all of the other communities we serve, and it accounts for about one-third of our total kilowatt-hour sales. We have a lot of capital projects that are ongoing. We've been very fortunate, although we don't have resources that others might talk about as far as hydropower or anything like that. We certainly don't have gas availability like they do on the rail belt, but we have been very fortunate in receiving funding from federal and state government in order to do capital projects that allow us to integrate renewables, both wind and solar. We've been adding energy storage. We've been looking at marine feasibility studies. We've been developing our interconnection with broadband internet and upgrading our cybersecurity so that we don't feel too bad about connecting our operational equipment through the internet to our home office. We're in negotiations with the federal government for a substantial grant in order to help boost our cybersecurity with all those communities. And we hope to deploy SCADA over the next few years. Presently, our power plant operators, who are our front line, operate and maintain our power plants on a day-to-day basis, and they still fill out their plant logs and fax them in once a week. That's how we keep track of how things are going. Mobilization freight costs are high. I know most of you folks have had some exposure to rural Alaska. When you land in a plane out there with all of your gear, there's no terminal building, typically not a place to get warm. There's a snow removal equipment building where they store the loader or the grader that clears the runway, and people are usually either huddled on the sunny side or on the non-windy side of the SREB waiting for the plane. You offload, and gear gets dispersed by four-wheelers and pickup trucks. If it's wintertime, it's snow machines and trailers. And in the summertime, we have the ability to move larger amounts of freight and fuel by barge. When a barge comes to a community, there's not a large port facility. They're usually just pulling up to a sandbar or a muddy bank to discharge freight. We've been at this for a while. AVEC was originated back in 1968, and the tanks you see in the front center of that picture were probably sent to the community of New Stoyahawk in the early 70s. We received funding to replace the tanks in New Stoyahawk, and these tanks were in better shape than the ones that were in Equoc, so they got moved to Equoc. They're repainted. They got the bungs cut out of them. We put in flanged appurtenances so that we could attach new valves. But it's making do with the materials you have because of the extreme cost of actually getting new products out into the communities. The picture of the diesel engine in the lower left is just a typical 500 kW unit. We usually have 3 to 4 diesel generators in each community of various sizes to meet various loads. Our peak loads are typically in the wintertime. We do have one community, Yakutat, that still has a fish processing plant, and their peak load is in the summer. Because of poor fish returns, poor economics, offshore processors, those sorts of things, we used to have, I think, 5 different processing facilities within our system. The one in I'm forgetting the name of the one in the upper Yukon, but it's closed many years ago. The one in Amonik at the mouth of the Yukon closed probably 5 years ago. Togiak closed like 3 years ago. Bethel used to have fish processing back in the 70s. That's a long gone thing. Quinnahawk closed probably 10 years ago. It moved off to Platinum and then closed a few years later. So there's not a lot of industrial or commercial, large commercial sources for revenue for AVEC or load growth in our communities. Our linemen are typically climbing the poles. We do have bucket trucks in Bethel and Yakutat, but for the most part, they're digging holes by hand, climbing poles with belts and hooks, and lifting transformers with blocks and tackle. We have about 90 full-time employees. The front line of our power plant operations are with our local power plant operators. It's a part-time job that they can maintain the power plant, review what's going on, make sure that the day tank is full, that there's no leaks or spills, and they're running the proper size engine for the load. We have about 40 traveling technicians, linemen, mechanics, welders, carpenters, those sorts of folks that go out and build our larger projects or take care of larger maintenance. And those are all primarily stationed out of Anchorage. Fuel supply is critical for all of our communities. Although we've been integrating renewables for the last 25 years, still 95% of our generation comes from diesel fuel. Not only does that provide for electricity, but it also provides for heat in all of those communities, and it also provides for their transportation. The way fuel supply in Western Alaska works is the vendors typically hire a tanker, they fill it with fuel, and then they have lighterage barges that go out to that tanker. The tanker comes in and moves up the coast as the snow and ice melts, and those lighterage barges go back and forth from the tanker to the communities up the rivers, deliver fuel, and go back all summer long, ferrying back and forth as the tanker moves north, and then they turn around and start heading south, and hopefully they can top off those places that need a little extra fuel before winter. Looking at the equivalent cost of energy, I've converted some of this information from the cost of diesel fuel into BTUs. So a million BTUs is a standard way of looking at energy. It's about a million cubic feet of natural gas. When you look at the cost of our barge delivered fuel, which is between $3 and $5 a gallon, you're looking at anywhere between $20 and $40 per million BTU. We have fly-in communities, no attack. We always have to fly in fuel. There's a few places in the upper Kobuk where we periodically have to fly in fuel. And then we're talking over $10 a gallon for the cost of fuel. And that's no markup. That's what it costs us to get it into our tanks. And then you're talking closer to $90 per million BTU. Comparing that to the rail belt where they get gas from the Cook Inlet, they're about $7.50 per million cubic feet or million BTU. And there's a lot of wailing and consternation about the cost of gas going up, probably going to double in price, depending on what solutions come. And that's still well below the cost of fuel in rural Alaska. And again, just mentioning that it's not just electricity, it's also heating people's homes. So people are on the edge of being able to afford heating their homes, buying electricity, and sometimes it's a decision between food and heat and lights. So it can be difficult out there. Power cost equalization is a tremendous benefit to rural communities, and could not stress enough the continuation of power cost equalization and the protection of the PCE fund, but it is not a doesn't solve all the problems. Only a portion of electricity is eligible for PCE, so schools and commercial accounts are not eligible for PCE. It's really just residential and community facilities. Only a portion of that is paid for through PCE. So in the end, 80% of the cost of energy that AVEC supplies is paid for by the folks in those communities, the businesses, and 20% is roughly reimbursed by PCE. Where does AVEC spend its money? On the left, you see a multicolored part of the pie chart, and those are broken out into the systems of standard accounts where the Rural Utility Service, everything from cost of generation expense, distribution expense, interest expense, those sorts of things. And the big blue part of that pie chart is just the cost of fuel. So everything that we do is very dependent on the cost of fuel. It accounts for more than 50% of all of our costs of electricity. I mentioned that we do have been using renewable energy. It is a great benefit for the communities that get it, but not all the communities have it. And it's still not a 100% solution or displacement of diesel fuel. I wanted to share a little bit, in particular, a host of projects that we did in St. Mary's over the last 10 years. St. Mary's and Mountain Village are along the Yukon River. They're about 18 miles apart, and they used to be independently operated with two separate power plants. Over the last 10 years, we were able to build a power line between the two. There is a gravel road, so it made it a little bit easier for access. We put in a 900 kW wind turbine. We built a larger power plant in St. Mary's that feeds both of them, so we've improved energy efficiency both in our diesel generation, but we've also been consistently able to displace 40 to 50% of diesel fuel for those communities. Those communities include Mountain Village, St. Mary's, Pickus Point, and Andrewski. I want to compare that to another place folks might be familiar with. So 18 miles from St. Mary's to Mountain Village. It's also 18 miles from Thane Road up to Auk Bay in Juneau. A little bit different scenario as far as the amount of power use that goes on between those things. If we zoom in to downtown Juneau, you can see familiar neighborhoods here. You'll see that I've circled the Capitol building, the Dixon Courthouse Assembly building, and the state office building across the street. And if I put those buildings and their power use throughout the year on the graph that I showed earlier of the communities of AVEC, you will see that the buildings themselves consume more energy than most of the communities that we serve. The state office building that's across the street is equivalent to the amount of power in the facilities that I just showed you for Mountain Village and St. Mary's. So in Mountain Village and St. Mary's, we have two airports, we have two K-12 schools, we have two stores, we have a sub-regional clinic, we have a clinic, we have housing for, I think, 1,200 people, and they use about the same amount of energy as the building across the street. So the Power Cost Equals Ocean program is tremendous benefit for folks. And I think people get a little antsy when you say, well, now people are just using too much power. I don't think the realities in rural Alaska, the economics, allow people to use too much power. And it is a great benefit and should be protected at all costs.
Thank you, Mr. Salmon. I think it's appropriate to note, as we think about efficiently using funds, the electricity costs here in Juneau are far lower than in those communities. So although the usage is much higher, the dollars are a lot less.
Thank you for that. So just in summary, why is electricity expensive in rural Alaska? I can let you read through that, but it really is the distances that we have to cover, the small economies of scale. All of our costs have to be spread out over a very low amount of kilowatt hour sales. Remote and difficult to access. I think I talked to some of my friends. They're going to probably talk a little bit more about workforce and being able to maintain qualified folks to do this kind of work. It's a challenge. So some of our strategies to reduce cost of power is to improve generation efficiency, minimize distribution losses, interconnect our villages when we can to create a greater economy of scale, add renewables when we can, capture and sell recovered heat. I didn't speak too much about that, but there is a lot of heat that's given off in diesel generation, and we have been successful in being able to port that out to other community buildings and schools in order to displace some of the diesel fuel that they need for heating buildings. Promoting energy education and workforce development for our communities and supporting economic growth are all critical to maintaining and sustaining reliable power in rural Alaska. And I don't know if we're doing questions now or later.
We can do a couple of clarifying questions now before we get to the panel. Is that a nodding off of a question, Representative Edson? You can think about
I'll
it, too.
I'll defer to Representative Holland.
Co-Chair Holland.
Oh, okay. Great. Thank you. Through the chair, just a high-level clarifying question on the experience you see looking across all the villages and projects. What role are renewable projects having in the supply of power and the cost of power? I noticed in that last slide we just looked at, I don't recall seeing renewable projects being a key part of that. What is the current penetration of renewables across the whole AVEC family? And is that now to a point where it's stabilized, or is there still growth opportunity? And is it contributing to managing the cost of power, or is it now just diversifying it so there's a little more reliability? I'm just wondering how renewables fits into the picture.
I think we're still just scratching the surface in the amount of renewable penetration that could be built. It is very cost intensive. We rely heavily on grant funding to make those projects go forward. We still have a number of projects that are in the pipeline. We've seen a change in events over the last year, so there's not a whole lot of money still coming out of the federal government as far as building out wind, solar, battery projects, those sorts of things. But we have a number of projects. We are working with the tribes in, I think, 20 different communities to become independent power producers. They've received funding to build solar energy storage systems. So as they build those out over the next 5 to 6 years, we'll be buying power from the tribe at a cost less than what it costs us to buy diesel fuel. So that creates a little bit of workforce development, keeps money in the community, and provides a lower cost of energy. The amount of penetration right now that we have is 5% of our total generation is renewable.
Just a quick follow-up.
Coach Rahan.
Thank you for that. I'm just curious at a high level again, if 5% is current penetration, if you look out 10 years, are we going to double that to 10%? Does it become someday 40%? I'm just curious an order of magnitude of what that opportunity in renewables looks like down the road.
I think a key component there is going to be what energy storage looks like. That seems to be a burgeoning, you know, seems they can store more energy for less. Being able to utilize solar for longer durations, or being able to bridge the gaps between high winds and low winds. We don't have a lot of hydro resources. We have been looking into hydrokinetics, run of river sorts of things. Any of those items that could provide base load like a diesel would be beneficial. Hydro can fill those voids, but for wind and solar, it really becomes a challenge to figure out how to fill in those gaps when the resource isn't available, and energy storage would be a big component of that. So if I had to guess, certainly 10% is doable. Beyond that, I think it would really depend on what sort of energy storage we would be able
to get. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we can get more into this when we've got everybody up there too and get a variety of answers on
thank you.
Some of those system things. So thank you very much, Mr. Stamm. So as we're changing out presentations here in the room, I'd also like to remind folks that might not be in the room that presentations are available, uploaded to BASIS. So, you can see some of those beautiful shots of rural Alaska that not everyone gets to see. So with no further questions, we will move on to Tom Atkinson, CEO of the Kotzebue Electric Association.
Yeah, you guys could do each other's.
That looked pretty tropical for Kotzebue. thank you. Just got our presentations up there. And as a reminder, if you go through, if you can either give a number or title of the slide for anyone that might be following along at home.
Name is, first of all, I'd like to thank Co-Chair Mears and Holland and the rest of the members of the committee for inviting rural cooperatives here today to share our story. We all know that a lot of the energy in the legislature is going to be tied up in the natural gas pipeline. And I really want to thank you for giving us the voice to share our stories about rural communities that largely will not receive benefit from that natural gas pipeline. We're certainly not opposed to it, but we want to make sure that there's some equity in how we look at this and the benefit for all Alaskans of these energy resources. Having said that, yes, this is a picture that is a little less tropical than Cordova, and this is springtime in Kotzebue, so it gets much worse than that. As I said, I am the general manager of the Kotzebue Electric Association. Kotzebue is a community of about 3,000 people. We are a generation and distribution cooperative. We have no choice but to do both because we're a microgrid. We're not getting our power from any other place. I'm sure you guys are fully aware of that, but I just wanted to go ahead and point it out. We're 31 miles above the Arctic Circle. You can only get in and out by air. So that's where we're at. We have been in existence about 73 years. Willie Hensley, in his book 50 Years to Tomorrow, noted that it was a great innovation when electricity came to Kotzebue because they no longer had to light coffee cans full of diesel to light the runway so the planes could come in. Ever since then, we have been largely dependent on diesel generation until the late 90s. In the late 90s, KEA began to develop wind energy, first with 60 and 100-watt wind turbines. And in 2012, we made a huge leap to two 900-kilowatt wind turbines. And you see one of them in the picture on the left there. One of the things that we needed to do, since these were installed in 2012, they're getting to be middle-aged. The average life expectancy of a wind turbine is 20 to 25 years. One of the main components in a wind turbine is a converter, which converts the raw electricity into usable electricity for the grid, needed to be replaced. That came at a very high cost of about $300,000. Fortunately, our partnership with the academic community, the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, allowed us to partner with them to receive a grant. They obtained grant funding for us for the converters, which we had installed. So that's one of our strategies to continue to move forward, is to work with the academic community. We continue to do that on a number of different projects. Of course, nothing is easy given the time of year that we tried to do that. We did have some issues in terms of the wiring on those, causing some overheating and a couple of months down with our wind turbines when we needed them to be functioning, so we didn't need to burn as much fuel. As I point out in this slide there, replacing converters in November is not an easy task. Producing electricity in rural communities is not easy. Anything that you do in rural communities is twice as hard because of the distance, the workforce that we have. Some of the people that you see in this picture were technicians from our wind turbine manufacturer whose home base is in the Netherlands. So these people are coming from further away than the lower 48. They're coming from Europe. And again, that highlights the need that Bill mentioned earlier about developing a workforce within Alaska that can respond to these types of needs. So any opportunities that the legislature has to push money forward to Votex or other institutions that can develop these types of skills for fixing diesel generators or renewable energy assets, that would pay great dividends to reducing the cost of producing energy in rural communities. So with our wind turbines and also the solar farm, which I'll talk about later, and our battery storage, we have the capacity to do about 30% of our electricity generation through renewable energy. And I'll put a caveat to that. That's when everything is working. And in rural communities, and Mel can probably testify to that, not everything is always working all at the same time. You're always facing some challenge to keep things going. This is a picture of one of our 3-megawatt generators. Diesel generation costs are high due to costly repairs on a fleet of aging diesel generators. And I know this is not only true for a KEA, but many of the rural communities have aging or aged out diesel generation, which they are basically hemorrhaging dollars to try to keep in operation every year. That's one of the key things that we need to focus on. We cooperate together as cooperatives. That's one of our cooperative principles, is cooperatives help cooperatives. We were in Cordova, as co-chair Mears was, in October. Clay was gracious to make his staff available to us. We looked at their operations there. They've been able to replace most of their diesel generation with newer, less expensive diesel generators, and they have cut their fuel costs in half. I'm sure I'm probably stealing Clay's thunder here, but you know, we thought, well, that's great. So we have been working with them, and we have been getting information about that, how we can begin to do that. So we're very encouraged by that. And these generators are 22% more fuel efficient. So that is the direction that we need to head. And we've been fortunate in that we have GRIP grant funding and also other funding from the Department of Energy that is going to help us do that in the next couple of years. One of the things that rural cooperatives deal with is aging infrastructure. The project that you're looking at here, which was completed in May of 2025, was replacing the heat exchangers, which were almost 40 years old, that were on the outside of our diesel generation plant that provide the cooling for all of the generators. This is something that we needed to get done, because if they failed during the middle of the winter, we would no longer be able to meet the demand of the community. And it was a huge undertaking, but it was made easier by the fact that we have diversified generation assets, and we could keep the renewables running to at least power part of the town while we did this project. So I think that's one of the great things, besides the fuel savings for diesel generation of renewables, is that you don't have all your eggs in one basket. So to do our core generation, we're still 70% diesel generation. You have to go ahead and bring in a lot of fuel. Last year, we bought in 1.1 million gallons of diesel to go ahead and supply that need. It's very costly to do this. And you never know what the pricing is going to be from year to year. You've got one shot to bring the fuel up once a year, as Bill described. It is what the cost is going to be at that point in time. We do lock in prices throughout about a 5-month period prior to receiving the fuel. So we try to see when the best opportunities are to lock in pricing for the fuel, and we try to get the best average price for our customer, for our members. We have been able to help the community in other ways with this fuel storage. Because of our renewables, we've been able to go ahead and rent or lease out part of one of our 1 million gallon tanks to a local fuel supplier who is new to the market, who is trying to compete against a more established fuel provider that's been in the market a longer period of time. They had no fuel storage. So to create a more competitive market, the board decided to go ahead and make this arrangement with this fuel supplier, and it is helping stabilize fuel prices in the community, not just for electric generation, but as Bill mentioned earlier, people use the diesel to heat their homes as well.
So, Mr. Atkinson, do you think we can take maybe 10 more minutes?
Sure.
Thank you.
Getting back to infrastructure projects, we have aging transformers. We only have one substation. We had one that was ready to fail, so we replaced that. But all of our transformers are going to need to be replaced within the next 3 to 5 years. This is a picture of our solar panels, and they are providing a lot of good electricity for us beginning about in this time of year through October is when we're going to get the best production out of those, and then it drops off during the winter months. We did replace the inverters on there because the ones that we had on there required too many software updates, too much downtime. So we replaced those. We have more uptime on our solar now. Of course, Bill also alluded to the need in all the communities for some type of storage as well. We went ahead and purchased our first battery in 2015. It's a 1 megawatt battery, and it has done well for us, but it's near the end of its life now. And we have received funding through Senator Murkowski's office and also through the Renewable Energy Fund to go ahead and replace this battery. And we're very fortunate that we can get a 4 megawatt battery in there. It will allow us to go a full 2 hours without any generation from the diesel plant or the renewables to go ahead and power the whole town. So we're very excited about that and feel very fortunate that we're going to be having a larger battery in our community. We also have another project that is in the planning stages now with the U.S. Air Force and also the KEA. We're going to be working together on a dual-use project for a battery that will support a long-range radar site and also community communication assets like cell phone towers and also radio towers and things like that. It will be the first dual-use project of its kind. We're very excited and hopefully we'll get this off the ground. It will also create another isolated grid for our community, which is very important. As I'll show you later, we have a lot of problems due to fall storms and rising water. We'll also be replacing an aged out transmission line that the airport with our GRIP grant funding. This project is very important because this line supports 5 state and federal entities in Kotzebue. We're very fortunate that we can finally do this. This has been an issue that we have been chasing for close to 20 years to get this line replaced. And here is a picture of the flooding that I mentioned earlier. I just think that the picture says it all there. That has been our community for the past 2 years. We certainly have not suffered the problems that the communities in the Yukon-Kuskokwim area did, but we do have water inundating homes and making us question the sustainability of our future on our current footprint. One of our asks from the legislature is also to continue as a long-term project to look at how these communities can continue to be sustainable with these issues.
So Mr. Atkinson, you mentioned that there was a, when we met earlier, a seawall or a berm that it's now regularly topping, and not only topping from the front side, but water rising is coming around on the back end. So, which leads me to believe that things are becoming more extreme. It was designed for historic and we're regularly surpassing historic levels.
Yeah. The native name for our community is Kikikdagruk, and that means almost an island. We're surrounded on side by three waters. I'm surrounded on three sides by water. And during the flood, actually, all of the exit routes out of the community were blocked and flooded. Water coming over the runway, which is our lifeline. This is a problem that may trump all of the other problems that I'm explaining to you today, but it does not have a short-term solution. Some of our energy problems definitely are more short-term and can be addressed, and we can make progress.
Thank you.
As I alluded to earlier, this is a picture of the proposed pipeline path, and I just point out to people that's not anywhere near where we live. And if you look at the P in pipeline there, that little isthmus of land that goes out into the sound right there, that's us. We need to make sure that we're building a mechanism that makes this project benefit all communities in Alaska. And just the takeaways from this, we want to make sure we focus on workforce development, as I talked about earlier. We at KEA have come to realize that we need to have a balanced approach to generation development. When we first started developing wind and then solar and battery, we thought, man, we're going to take it all the way at 100% renewable. And over time, we found that it's probably feasible to get to 50%, but 100% is hard with intermittent sources like wind and solar. When other resources come online, like micronuclear or hydrogen, there is a good chance that we can get closer to that. But until then, we have to make sure that we're balanced in taking care of our diesel generation assets as well as our renewable assets. Future load growth, the community of Kotzebue is seeing building growth that it has not seen in a long time. We're looking at a possible 10% increase in our demand, and we're looking at how are we going to meet that demand in the next 3 to 5 years. The hospital is building new patient and staff housing. Local Native Corporation is also building more housing in town. A new AC store was built in town within the past 2 years. It's using more electricity than it did before, and we're just seeing that in a number of different places. Resilience, we need to make sure we develop infrastructure outside of the areas that are being flooded annually. Affordability, we just need to make sure that we continue to make sure that we're providing affordable energy for our members. And part of that involves, you know, helping us by doing things like protecting the PCE and also making sure that the Renewable Energy Fund is funded annually. Support, we need all the support that we can from the legislature. We've been very creative in how we get our funding. About 75% of our funding is federal. Then next after that would probably be the state, the academic community, the local Native corporations. NANA has passed through grants to us, as has other local entities, and KEA's even taken money out of their own pocket. So we're not looking for the state to solve all of our problems, but to continue to support us in what we're trying to do. I'm just, trying to provide electricity or support the people that do in a very small community. I'm not supporting almost 60 communities like Bill is with AVEC, but it's still a tremendous challenge for every community that does this, and all the help that we can get in doing that is important. We are a hub community. We're the gateway to the NANA region, which is rich in resources that may be developed in the near future here, and it's important to our state that we continue to invest in the infrastructure in these rural communities. So that's all I've got. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Atkinson. Yeah, just a reminder that there are a lot of programs out there that have got benefits in different ways out there. And I know it's a lot of work to try and put all those pieces together to make things happen. So,
yep. One of those programs is through the Alaska Energy Authority. They do have programs to help replace generators, but it's for communities with a population of less than 2,000 people. So we're kind of a little bit over that line with 3,000 people. So, yes, there are some resources out there. Some we can take advantage of, some we can't.
Thank you very much. Any questions before we move to Cordova? Representative Costello.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. You had mentioned in one of your slides that complying with state regulations can be challenging. If there are any that you think would help, and if we need to look at some of those in order to make things easier for you, just I think we'd be open to that discussion.
I'm glad you asked that. Yes, we do do a lot of work with the Department of Environmental Conservation, which they closely monitor our emissions. In fact, they send us a bill at the end of the every year for the amount of emissions that we've put out into the air. And it is also very costly to comply with the testing and sampling. And I understand it's all for very good reasons, but it is a very large part of the expenses that we have to deal with in diesel generation. So there are a number of ways that hopefully we can do, we could lessen the burden of the compliance. I don't have any specifics for you right now, but that is definitely an opportunity to help save rural communities some money.
Thank you very much.
Nope, not right now.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
So we will move down to our more tropical photo and down to Cordova for Mr. Clay Copeland, CEO of the Cordova Electric Association. Thank you for hosting the APA conference this past fall and joining us today in Juneau.
And thank you, co-chairs, mayors, and Holland, and committee for the invitation. My name is Clay Copeland, CEO of Cordova Electric Cooperative, and also currently serving as the chair of the Alaska Energy Authority Board. So I might sprinkle in just a couple AEA pieces. So Cordova is a rural, remote, isolated microgrid, but there are ways that it kind of differs from Kotzebue's and Alaska Village Electric systems, and there are some similarities that we actually share with larger kind of rail belt utilities. So I kind of wanted to touch on those because I think it kind of speaks to some of the current challenges and opportunities and focus that you as legislators have on energy right now. So this is just the Cordova waterfront, and Cordova does have a large industrial base, and investments in energy by the community and the cooperative and by the state and federal government have helped us build our energy infrastructure and reduce our energy prices. And that has supported our seafood industry and really grown that industrial base in a beneficial way. And it's also reduced pressure on the power cost equalization program because Cordova at one time was the largest recipient from that program, but have been able to reduce our rates and keep them somewhat flat, a lot flatter than inflation. We have closed the gap between our rates and the rail belt rates of they have risen. So we've just been eligible for less and less credit over time. And that's a great path to kind of wean ourselves off that program and take pressure off that program that other communities need, maybe a little more. So I just, again, wanted to talk to maybe some side elements. So Cordova is kind of a leading and innovating utility because we have that industrial base and resources. And I do want to acknowledge we have some of our professional staff and board in the room. Emma Merritt is our finance manager, and Leif Stavig is our executive assistant. And then Joe Cook has been our longtime board chairman, but he's passed the baton to others on our board. And Joe is still serves on our CEC board. And I wanted to call them out because it's an ecosystem. We have board support who are willing to take risks and engage with the community and with staff. And then staff that we all have our own strengths and skill sets. But collectively, that's given us a capacity to innovate with battery energy storage and kind of next generation applications, to work with the Department of Energy and our University of Alaska to bring forward new technologies. And sometimes we usually try to be on the cutting edge of technology, the leading edge, but not the bleeding edge. But we've had a lot of challenges and a lot of changes just in the global environment around us the last few years. That we're still adapting to, but the advent of social media, the pandemic, and before and kind of after, and now the advent of big data and artificial intelligence is not only putting pressure on our infrastructure, but just the social equation has changed a little bit. But we've been kind of adapting to that through putting more focus on our engagement with our customers, especially in businesses, to better understand their needs through surveys and really amplifying our customer appreciation and annual meeting events where we can have attendance of up to 20 to 25% of our entire membership engaged. And that's really helped us to really focus and make sure that we're moving in the direction that our community and businesses need us to. And I'm highly collaborative with you as a state and the programs for the Alaska Energy Authority, our own businesses and community, and also, as I mentioned, the federal government and their funding programs. And really focusing on our strategies. And so our strategy is to reduce energy costs mostly through growing our sales. And I'll talk to that on another slide. But I'm also looking at the whole picture for the community. How can we, as Tom mentioned, having dual purpose facilities that can meet maybe an energy and a community water need, or an educational and a recreational and a energy need in the community, and trying to make sure we get them the best and broadest use out of these big capital investments for the community. So,
we've got a moment, yes. Representative Costello.
Thank you. If we could go back to the previous slide.
Yes.
What is it that we're looking at in this slide?
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I have not talked a lot about the Cordova Electric system, but this is one of our two run-of-the-river hydroelectric projects. It provides about 10% of our community's energy, but we're in the process of making some equipment upgrades in there that we think we can expand that output 40% with the same amount of water. And that's really been our story over the last 3 or 4 years, is really optimizing the diesel plant, as Tom had mentioned. We're breaking records for our fuel efficiency. They're smaller units, that the parts are more available and cheaper. Our own staff are installing them and doing the maintenance, even the rebuilds on them. So that helps internalize and help us manage costs, but also understand our equipment and system really well and be able to manage it. So these are on salmon creeks. So they're very low impact and kind of a model. And as Tom mentioned in Kotzebue, we share very broadly across our industry. So I was talking to Alaska Village Electric Cooperative Engineers 2 weeks ago about the data platform that we use that gives us 20 years of history right at our fingertips and so forth. So I don't want to over-answer, but trying to touch on some different themes. Now, our Power Creek project is also a run-of-the-river project, and we approach 70% of our community's power needs with that. Really, just with some simple valve changes and efficiency upgrades, we're getting 15% more power out of that project in the summer during our peak demands of seafood, and as much as twice as much energy out of it in the winter, just by putting more efficient valves in. So sometimes there's low-hanging fruit, and we've been able to capture some of that. But what we don't have, and Tom alluded to this in Kotzebue, is energy storage. We don't have a dam storage element in our system. And that means that we sometimes, you can kind of see a little bit of water spilling over here and going downstream. At our other project, there's often a lot of water. So we have sometimes megawatts of excess energy capacity and nowhere to sell it until data came along with an opportunity. And I'll talk about that on another slide. So this is just a top view of that small project. So as I mentioned, our primary goal is to reduce energy costs. And the way that we can keep pressure off of rates is by increasing our economy of scale. Now, as Bill mentioned with AVEC, that trying to spread the high cost of our infrastructure across a small amount of kilowatt hours really puts pressure on your rates, especially when you have excess renewable energy available. So some of the new technologies, this is one of our facilities that we're heating with new air to hot water heat pumps. We have a test site agreement with the manufacturer, and I can't say their name because we're also under non-disclosure, but we're testing these on our facility and hope to roll those out sometime this summer when they become commercially available, and can help our customers offset their heating costs, which saves them with their overall energy costs. But it also takes pressure off the electric rates by selling more kilowatt hours. So we're also looking at some electric vehicles, the data industry, of course, growing opportunities in our own seafood industry. And then we've done a lot of work. Emma has done some really innovative work in structuring our electric rates to better grow sales, still recover the revenue that we need to, that give our customers opportunities to maybe utilize air source heat pumps more cost effectively, both our residences and our businesses. So try to help find that sweet spot of growing economic opportunities and diversifying our sales and growing our sales without increasing the cost. So I want to talk a little bit about data, and especially we've had a lot of these conversations now and are starting to understand some of the new opportunities. This isn't the Bitcoin from several years ago where they're looking for 5 cent power. This is energy is in a scarce market right now. It's a commodity, as we talked about this morning. So higher energy rates aren't going to scare off the data industry, especially in Alaska, where very often the cooling is a bigger energy cost than the data processing equipment itself. And we have a very cool environment. So if they're only using enough, a third as much energy overall to produce the same amount of data, that means our rates can be higher, and they're still very competitive in Alaska. We do need the fiber connectivity, high reliability on the grid. That's something that Cordova with our underground power lines just has in our native power delivery. So we were a really good space to start the data industry. And this speaks to, it would represent about 20% of our power demands in the winter in terms of the peak load. And it would also represent about 20% of our annual sales. So it kind of is somewhere in the neighborhood of like House Bill 529, for example, is a significant load. So we are working with our board and attorney to have special service agreement to make sure that we are not putting new cost on the other customers, that this, and ultimately we want data to be a benefit to all the customers in the community, and to have a new industry to diversify our economy as well. A fairly small data footprint would use about the same amount of energy as our entire seafood industry. So that means we don't have to just hit our one industry if we need to raise more revenues. And seafood industry has been struggling a little bit recently anyway.
So I think this is a good example of, like, a practical example in Alaska of how a potential new large load user can come in and provides opportunities for the community. And it seems like the relationship that you've had with GreenSpark has been very collaborative.
Yes.
Not just to work with the energy, I mean, mostly to work with your energy utility and its systems to utilize extra power that you've got at a time. But it seems like they've been very collaborative in that process as well.
Yeah, they want to, you know, and they're in a slightly different space, and they are looking for renewable energy. They want to, you know, they like to see social benefits to the community with their business in the community. So they've been good partners. But also we've, you know, we're really collaborative as a cooperative. So we know that the city has a fairly taxed water infrastructure. So as we move through design, we want to say, okay, you have closed loop cooling and ambient cooling that won't put demands on our existing infrastructure there. Housing is very challenging. I'll finish up with workforce development here, but available housing is one of the challenges for us to get professional, you know, employees from outside the community. So on the one hand, you'd say, well, the data industry doesn't bring new jobs to your community. But the other side of that coin is that they're also not putting pressure on housing, our other existing infrastructure. So we are very carefully trying to right size it, because if we tried to integrate enough data, ultimately we're going to start burning more diesel fuel and actually putting upward pressure on rates. But we're trying to find that sweet spot where by selling a lot of our hydro that doesn't have a market now, that puts downward pressure on everybody's rates. So yeah, you do have to be kind of intentional there. So workforce development, and I appreciated in the panel that we had with the Alaska Power Association yesterday, Representative Holland brought this up that, you know, workforce development is our, as the manager of the cooperative, is our number one challenge. In the Alaska Energy Authority, we had our strategic planning last Friday. They're about 70% staffed for the projects and programs that they have right now. So, and we look through that organizational chart and can see right to the positions that some of those large capital projects are going to create as many as 1,500 jobs. Someone has to fill those positions. And we would like to have that be Alaskans and to have their income and their financial activity stay in the state. So, you know, we're wrestling with new opportunities for employees to work remotely or commute or have flexible jobs. So we do have some opportunities, though, I think, through our university program and our trade schools to focus on the new infrastructure, economic development, the energy that we're doing. So maybe a little more focus on engineering curriculums through the university, through our own primary education, our local schools, clear down to fourth grade. The employees that were born and raised in Cordova that work there now, Leif and Emma both included, you know, when I talked to them about what brought you back to Cordova Electric, it was those fourth grade Safety City programs. It was the field trips that we do with the grade schools and the high school, the lectures that we sometimes are asked to do in their classrooms. The summer work programs where we have them work in our power plant or with our line crew or in the customer service office. Every one of them mentioned one of those or multiple of those paths back to working there. So we as utilities can be doing a better job. And I think you as legislators can be signaling our universities and stuff that let's really be emphasizing the skill sets and the jobs we need to fill going forward. And that's really what I had. Be glad to answer any questions now or as a group.
Thank you. I think that's good for the moment. Thank you very much, Mr. Copeland, and okay. Your support in the audience as well.
Okay. Well, the other thing I forgot to mention on workforce development is one really bright glimmer is $100 million of Denali Commission funding for bulk fuel tank farm upgrades in rural Alaska. There are huge risks and liabilities out there. The Alaska Energy Authority did a good job of doing drone coverage and identifying and prioritizing, which are literally in some cases feet from eroding riverbanks and 30 or 40 years old. So, but again, we're going to need the people and the tanks and the contractors available to go implement that. $50 million of that is going to be proctored by Alaska Village Electric Cooperative and the other $50 million by the Alaska Energy Authorities. Thank you.
Thank you. And then we've got our last presenter. Thank you for coming, Mr. Cheney, from the CEO of the Nooshaghat Cooperative. I will get your slides up, and thank you for sharing. Please put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. To and through the chairs, to co-chairs Mears and Holland, Will Cheney, CEO, GM, Nooshaghat Cooperative in Dillingham, Alaska. I'd like to start by thanking the committee for spending some very valuable time, of your very valuable time, with the rural cooperatives. It is, we've been to Juneau a number of times, and as I can attest, the rail belt usually gets a lot of the attention, so this is very valuable time. I'll try to make it so. I'd also like to take a moment to thank Michael Rivito and Chris Langfist with APA for pulling us together down here. Okay. I don't relish self-introductions, but in this case, I think it's important because I consider myself a product of my community and my cooperative. I was born and raised in Dillingham. My wife was raised in Dillingham, adopted into the community. We've raised five children. All are presently, short of the one who is starting college this year, are residing in Dillingham. We put two through college and they've returned. That to me is incredibly important. We've got two in high school and middle school. I've been at the cooperative 25 years. You can see the path there. I started at the cooperative with some line experience, and my goal was to obtain my certificate of fitness as a journeyman lineman. I was able to do that and progress through the cooperative. It's a path that that cooperatives can claim a lot of success, not just with myself, but with others. Very important in the smaller communities. Some more of the background, growing up in Bristol Bay, of course, I participated in the salmon fisheries, both set net and drift, growing up. I did get to participate in the Togiak herring fishery, which no longer exists. That is one of those things that, that has effects on our communities, for sure. So worked construction, in Dillingham, both dirt work and general construction. I've seen a slowdown in those industries in our community, as well. Those opportunities don't exist to the extent that they did. And then of course, sport fishing, co-owned and operated a sport fish camp that was unguided, and was guiding for others while that was occurring. So, more importantly, our cooperative, and who we are and what we do. You can see on the left there the thumbnails of our current board members and their times in service. I'll talk about that a little bit in a minute, but the cooperative itself, we've got 20 full-time employees with 9 vacancies. That number fluctuates a little bit, but it is challenging. Combined utility, providing electric, telephone, and internet. We carried cable television as long as the internet allowed it to exist, and as it has pretty much around the globe, cable television is struggling, and we let that option go. 994 members, right at 1,500 meters, over 97 miles of distribution. We presently do not have any transmission, like was previously mentioned. 11.2 megawatts of diesel generation. We are 100% diesel. And that's, we'll talk about that, of course, as well in a bit. But 2.7 million gallons of storage, which holds our energy for the year. We convert about 1.3 million gallons of that diesel to energy, and energy in electricity and supplemental heat. We've got a supplemental heat system that one of my predecessors from years ago, Dave Bowker, implemented a supplemental heat system that provides that energy to our both of our city schools in elementary and high school, as well as the Southwest Region School District office and a state maintenance shop. Very, very valuable resource. And then, of course, we provide about $1.8 million in wages into our community annually, which is incredible. Leadership and cooperative history in our community. We began as a private company years and years and years ago, transitioned to a PUD, a public utility district, and it was in 1964 that we became a member-owned cooperative. That's a 62-year history in Dillingham, and there are very few businesses that can claim that in a rural, especially, and in Dillingham. We have the fishery, 125 plus years, we're governed by a 9-member volunteer board. I thought I would have my longest serving board member in Henry Strube here. Henry has dedicated 42 years of his life to our community and our cooperative, as a volunteer. Incredibly valuable. Henry is a true champion for cooperatives and for our community. I wanted to recognize him for that. Very important, member-owned, not-for-profit, community success is cooperative success. That's another aspect that's hard to find in the smaller communities. A lot of businesses, of course, profit is the motive. Not the case with cooperatives. Ours is to recover enough to continue to provide services to our community. So, I talked about it a little bit earlier, but over time, we've as the cooperative, we assumed the telephone provision in Dillingham. I think it was 1974. It was a member-driven initiative. The service that we were enjoying was from an outside company, and it was lacking. So we had some members get together in those early 70s and put forth an initiative to the cooperative. They were convinced that the cooperative could provide better telephone service. We bit, took on the telephone, and today we're still providing telephone. We went through, I mentioned earlier, the cable TV provision, and then have moved into internet provision as well. I talked about the heat recovery and sharing with surrounding businesses. That's been incredibly important, in fact, important enough that I received a text about it while we were waiting for this meeting out in the hall to get together with one of the end users about about that heat recovery system that they're using. And on a much smaller scale, the used oil from our generators. We've been sharing that with a few of our members that are using used oil burners to avoid the cost of heating oil. So I'll go over some of the regional challenges and then cooperative challenges, and we'll move into the successes. I tried to end on a high note. some of the regional challenges, things that affect Bristol Bay, credentialed employees at the co-op and in the community. It's not just the co-op and finding linemen and finding accountants and finding administrators. It is across the board, whether it is the hospital or Bristol Bay Native Association, the state DOT office, the schools. That challenge has an effect on us on the amount of services that our community can provide to the other associated businesses. remote work changed many of the core businesses in Dillingham. What were some of the higher paying jobs, more stable positions in Dillingham have transitioned out of Dillingham. And in some cases, the people that perform those jobs either take that job to another community and continue doing it, or they move outright and pursue that work somewhere else for someone else. And in either case, it has an effect on our communities. And out-migration of talent, that's where it just goes and plies its trade elsewhere, right? Housing issues and the cost of construction in our small communities, this has a very big impact. We've had managers accept positions at the co-op and initially turn us down because they could not secure housing for their families. The bigger the family, the bigger the challenge, of course. But that is a reality that, I think affects all of us, all of the rural communities for sure. It has really shown up in Dillingham. We heard it mentioned, earlier by one of the others as well. Here's a big one. Dillingham is a hub community. We would love to have our entire staff, living in our community to ply their trade, and we've succeeded in not outsourcing any of the permanent jobs thus far. But it's becoming more challenging to attract and retain talent, at the higher levels, the administrators, the managers, the folks that generally have families that they're going to bring, getting people to pick up and move to rural Alaska is a challenge that I have seen grow in my 25 years at the co-op. So that's certainly worth mentioning. The cost of doing business as we lose these people, that are out migrating or choosing to work elsewhere, it has a direct effect on the services that are available in our community. And that drives the cost of doing business up. If we need snow removed, if we need fuel delivered, if we need our vehicles worked on, if we need carpenters to build something or plumbers to fix something, the costs have risen dramatically in the last few years. Industry in flux. Industry in Bristol Bay, certainly in Dillingham, is salmon. It's commercial fishing. Happy to report our two older sons are both permit holders, and the oldest has bought a boat. And our third son fishes with them. They're all on the same boat, which is cause for concern at times. But that industry. I say that to, you know, we monitor that industry as closely as we can. Things are changing. We just had a processor in Dillingham. It was one of, if not the oldest processing facility in the state. I think it opened in 1898. It hasn't gone away, but it changed names. And just that shift after 125 plus year history to change owners, is a sign of the times, I guess, that insecurity. So, but in that industry, that industry and the load it provides has shifted from canning salmon, which was steam, diesel powered steam, to fresh frozen, which is a market driven product. That's what the market wants, is to see the fillet and in its pristine condition. Flash frozen has driven electric demand through the roof. Climate change. This one is you could spend a lot of time on this one. What we found is the many, many facets of how it affects us. It affects us locally in the heating and cooling of our homes, fish returns, the biology of our region. It drives the fire hazards, the fire risks in our region. If we don't get a snow cover over the winter, we dry out faster, and now we're dealing with fire concerns. Water levels in the river. We actually had a year a few years back where one of the rivers was shallow enough that the sun heated it to the point where the salmon could not transition into the lake that fed that river, and that has a very direct effect on the runs and returns. But the construction season, of course, it affects that. But in the material availability, that's what we found is we're starting to hear, when we go looking for some of our products, whether they're wood poles or transformers, how climate change is affecting the vendors and providers that deliver those materials. the mining industry. The effects that climate change has on that drives their price up, which trickles down to us out, you know, as an end user. So cooperative challenge, some of these are very hand in glove with what we've already mentioned, but the effects they have at the cooperative level, I think top of the order, the single thread source of energy, us being 100% diesel reliant is a threat today. It is more so a threat than it has been in years past. It's been our friend and ally for a lot of years. But the way things are changing, that single thread is much more of a threat than it's been. Global energy insecurities, and again, directly related to the diesel and fossil fuel world, whether it is global politics or conflict, shipping issues, we have seen things on that global scale affect our access to energy. And again, speaking specifically to diesel, it is a threat. Fuel source and delivery. We are part of a Western Alaska Fuel Group. It's a contingent of five, if not six, cooperatives that pool our resource, our quantity of fuel, on the market and shop that around collectively. It has paid off over the years. It allowing us to shop a larger quantity gets us a better price for sure. Just one of the ways we try to hedge our bets there. Natural gas has been mentioned already, but the insecurities there, what happens to and on the rail belt has effects out in the bush. So that is something we don't have access to natural gas, but access to natural gas has a direct effect on our cooperative over time. So very much worth mentioning. And the environmental aspect, Tom, Mr. Atkins mentioned, you know, how that affects the emissions, the testing, tremendous cost to the cooperative. We spend at times, depending on the inspection schedules, well over $100,000 a year to satisfy our environmental concerns, the testing and the fees associated with that. Strong job market in the utility sector. When we, years past, we would advertise for journeyman linemen, we could expect to entertain 6, 7, 8 journeymen from across the country submitting applications. And Alaska is a destination for that individual. They want to come up, they want to hunt and fish. As the job market in the utility sector has continued to grow, there are less journeyman linemen available. So the jobs are paying more in the lower 48. The people that used to come up to look for a job so they could hunt and fish are now working in their home states and vacationing in our state to hunt and fish. And that has an effect on who we have available to us. That rise of material and goods, the cost of material and goods increasing, we're seeing 10 to 25% depending on the material. Wood goods and some of the smaller stuff is on the lower end. When you get into the copper and aluminum and steels, we're seeing right at a 25% increase in cost to operate. I spoke a bit about the cost of services, contractors, insurances, and regulatory. That's something with the inability to attract journeymen. Now we're looking for contractors to come in and fill those slots. And just as an example, I was looking for, I'm presently our journeyman lineman at home. It was a year and a half ago. I was looking for a break and started calling contractors in state to see if I could get a journeyman on site for a week. The number I got returned was $12,000 for a week's worth of coverage. And I can't do that. we're not going to do that. So that's the reality. That's some of the things we're dealing with. Again, climate change, with the regulatory costs, it's driving. We're literally our sole source of fuel is driving a climate change conversation. That's and when we start to talk about successes and opportunities, we'll get into that a bit. But that is one of the things that we need another answer.
So Co-Chair Holland, I think, had a question.
Thanks. And through the chair, you actually, I think, started to answer the question that I've been pondering since one of your early slides when you had mentioned you had 9 positions open. Mm-hmm. And you started, I think, to address that just a moment ago in terms of, you know, your use of perhaps contract. But I just was curious, given 9 positions out of what I assume would be 29, if you had everybody filled up, that's a lot of people that are in vacant position. I'm just wondering how that's affecting the operations, the expenses of a utility. I mean, that's a lot of folks for you to be somehow, what work's not getting done or how are you getting it done?
It generates a very many interesting conversations. We have a lot of folks wearing a lot of hats, and it is an additional stressor. On top of everything else we've discussed, that is one of the things when I go into work in the morning, that's a conversation I have with myself. Who is going to be doing what today, to what degree? Okay. And it doesn't allow you to plan your days or even projects in some cases very efficiently. And it definitely has an effect. And I've tried to kind of speak to it because that is one of the challenges that rural Alaska, I think, is on the, as Clay used the term, bleeding edge of. We are, if it was a money issue and we didn't, I mean, you guys are dealing with the same, but if money wasn't an issue for us and we could pay more and attract those people and fill those positions, that's one thing, but that, all the costs we see show up at the meter for us. So the question is, what can our communities support? And that is a question that I am seeing changing over time. The 80s and the 90s, we were able to answer those questions much more easily. There was more industry. I'll say the fishery was a bit more solid. There was construction happening. There were jobs, there were opportunities and things are certainly changing.
Well, thank you.
Please proceed.
Okay. So to speak to some of the successes, right out of the gate, world's largest wild sockeye salmon fishery. We're right at $2 billion annually, providing 15,000 jobs seasonally. That 100-year plus history, it's an amazing resource that the cooperative has supported since before it became a cooperative. We want to continue to support that. That right there is Bristol Bay in a nutshell. We are very fortunate to be supported by a strong contingent of what we call the BBs, Bristol Bays, Bristol Bay Native Corporation, Bristol Bay Native Association, Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, and a village corporation in Chugoyung Limited that provides support in region. These organizations are dealing with all of the issues I just mentioned and I'd like to say collectively we're working on solutions. We've come together and formed partnerships. I'll talk of some here in a minute, but there has been workforce development issues, grant opportunities that may not be available to the cooperative but are available to these other organizations that we've seen work together to provide answers to some of the questions mentioned. Strong trend towards workforce development. The BBNC, BBEDC provide interns programs that with providing employees that they have access to that we can use. We've begun creating partnerships in those areas. It is a regional success. Not ours yet. Battery and solar projects going in around the region. We're glad to see it. All of these microgrids, I think there are a lot of similarities in the conversations that my cohorts have brought to the table, and everybody's looking for an answer. In-river, run-a-river, renewable energy investments that are paying off. INN has a run-a-river project that our neighbor that they've implemented, and I believe it was 98. It's been online since and doing amazing things for those three small communities. Igeaugic has the in-river RivGen project that's doing similar. On an associated note, the Community Wildfire Protection Plan was just recently developed through a partnership with BBNA and the Alaska Venture Fund and stakeholders in Dillingham. wildfires are becoming more and more prevalent. If I remember the number correctly, I think it was 7,500% increase in acres burned in Bristol Bay due to lightning caused fires after a low snow year. It was a tremendous uptick, and there's a link there to the CWPP. The cooperative was a partner in developing that stakeholder. Really good work, and again, an example of our region trying to find answers collectively. So, of the 9 vacancies at the co-op, we are growing the workforce through training across the disciplines that we have. I've got a 4th-year apprentice at the co-op that is doing a wonderful job. He's also born and raised in Dillingham, and by all accounts, look like he is one that will stay once he gets his certificate of fitness. Happy there. We train our power plant operators as well as our accountants and administrators, trying to create a place that people want to come to work. Strong history of providing much needed energy and communication needs of our connected communities. I talked about that earlier. I have seen, since before my involvement with a cooperative, it step up to the plate in about any instance where there was a need in our community, whether it's taking on the telephone, taking on the cable TV. I'll talk about a broadband project here coming up, but our member-owned not-for-profit is anchored to the community. To the broadband, through a partnership with our village corporation, Chugging Limited, successfully completed a $29 million middle mile fiber project, extended the fiber from Leavelock over through Ekwok on the Nooshigak River into Aleknagik and then on to Dillingham, about 80 miles of open tundra terrain. Very challenging project. We didn't get the winter we needed. So as things happen in rural Alaska, it took longer than it needed to. It drove the costs a little out of kilter, but we managed to complete that. That project has already been shared with our neighboring region on the YK through a partnership with Bethel Native Corporation and GCI. They extended that fiber from Dillingham subsea up into 13 communities in the YK district. That is a foundation for our future communication networks in those two regions. Incredibly important resource that will allow for some of the growth. It's an answer to some of the needs and questions and needs that we're seeing. And very recently, as recently as last week, we've also received a provisional award for BEAD funding to connect the communities of Clark's Point and Manicotic to that very same fiber network. The money that is out there is very important to get a hold of. Now we are trying to anchor as much of these resources we can into our region so that in the future they will be available to not just the cooperative, but other communities as well. And we're going to switch gears and talk about energy. The cooperative since 2017 has been looking into Nuyukuk Hydro. Very interesting project. It was one that I approached as a manager initially with skepticism, having been born and raised here, having understand what the importance of salmon is to us. It got my attention, as it has many others, but the cooperative has since invested $6.2 million in member capital and another $2.5 million in grant funding in pursuing Nuyukuk Hydro, thanks to AEA, REF 13 and 14, very important resources for that feasibility assessment. That's one of the things the cooperative realized. It is challenging to get study funding for these projects. People want shovel ready, and I understand that. But for rural Alaska, in a case like this where it's salmon and or a renewable, there is a level of work that has to go into it that removes as much doubt as is possible, or it will not fly. It will not achieve social licensing, and that's very incredibly important. But AEA and Denali Commission came through, and we are at the stage where we are ready to submit a draft license application to FERC. We've completed the two-year study season. Once the draft license application is submitted, and that is waiting on my review. Once that's submitted to FERC, that kicks off a 90-day comment period and a review for FERC, at which point after that's eclipsed, we will then file a final license application with FERC. So some of the numbers, some of the reasons I'll say we're looking into hydro and other forms of renewable. Hydro, in this, we've looked into two other hydro resources in our region, in Grant Lakes and Elva, both in the Wood-Tikchik State Park, both smaller resources than Nuyukuk. And the cost benefit just wasn't there. Small enough resources with a high enough price tag that the recovery wouldn't pan out. Nuyukuk is a bit different, but we've also looked into wind with REAP. We scored a 3 on their scale of 1 to 7 in wind quality. It's just that math doesn't work either. But to look at our future on diesel generation, you can see the up in the top left there, it's extrapolated out over 10, 25, and 55 years. And then directly below that, we got our 1.3 million gallons this past summer, spring summer, and it came at a cost of 3.5 million. The industry wants a check for that. What used to be a line of credit, then now is turned into get a loan and write us a check. That's one of those hurdles with fossil fuels that has shown up recently, but you can see how it plays out over the years. And those numbers do not include the maintenance emissions and the bulk storage costs. I think I mentioned earlier our the cost of our fuel tank inspection was right at $500,000 this last summer for two tanks, two of the four.
So, Mr. Cheney, I'm looking at the clock, so if we can get through our project quickly, and then we can I can see some nods in the behind you of folks that some similar issues that we can all talk about.
I think I'm on my last slide, I believe, but just to give an overview of our region, bottom left corner, you can see Alaknagik there with a yellow line coming to it. Dillingham is basically right off the bottom of the screen there. I apologize for that. The horizontal green line from Alaknagik to Ekwok to the white dot in the bottom right corner, that tracks with our fiber line that I mentioned earlier, that about 80 miles from Leavelock, Ekwok, Alaknagik to Dillingham. And this green line is the proposed transmission line. We're right at about 50 miles when you're heading north and west, and then straight north up to the top, the gold star is where the Nuyukuk Falls is. One of the key aspects of a transmission line like this, first of all, transmission lines are cheaper than bulk fuel storage across the board. Every time one of our bulk fuel plants in Pick the Place has an issue, it falls to the state often to recover from the emergency, whether it's a leak, a spill, or emergency repairs. Those are tremendous costs that a transmission system in region could help alleviate. But we picked this route for a couple of reasons. One, following that fiber route, it's been permitted, it's been studied, we've already received easements for that route. But also it gets us over to the Nooshiegak River. You can see by this map, we settle on, around, or near the waters, whether it's a river or lakes. All of these communities, Alaknagik, Dillingham, Ekwok, Nooshiegak, Kalikinik, and Leavelock, are all on rivers or lakes and or lakes. So getting a transmission line that a project like Nuyukuk could create nearer the river speaks to future developments. Also, the vast expanses of land that transmission line crosses opens up possibilities for supplemental renewables. Keemuk Mountain there, where the line goes from north and west to north, that rock promontory, possibly windmills, possibly south-facing solar panels. Here's a depiction, and I believe this is the last slide, of the site at Nuyukuk Falls. This is a concept. These are the parts it would take to create a hydro site. So airstrip for operation and construction, the powerhouse, tail race, intakes, and so on. We're dealing with a low head resource at about 24 foot ahead. It require about 1800 foot penstock, right at 6,000 cubic feet per second flow capacity, 170 foot wide intake. And that's important because the dynamics of the river at 170 feet across, we could control the intake velocity to at or near that 1 foot per second, which would allow smolt to swim away and not become entrained. We're looking at 2 5-megawatt Kaplan turbines, fish-friendly turbines, and it could generate up to 34,000 megawatt hours annually, which covers our region, or Dillingham's 19,000, and our region's, the other connected communities' energy needs as well. So that's what I've got.
Excellent. Thanks so much. Let's take a brief video while we turn, pull some chairs up. We are back on the record with House Energy, and we have a full panel in front of us. So do we have any members of the committee that want to kick off a question? I got some queued up, but I'll leave that to the committee first. Representative Costello?
Well, thank you very much. It's been very interesting to have you here. I want to thank the co-chairs for having this opportunity today. So as we know, there's just one division that's necessitated in our Constitution, or named in our Constitution, and it's the Division of Community and Regional Affairs. And we've had a department named that, but it's a division now. And I was just curious, do you ever work through the division, or does the division ever help when you're looking at federal issues, or as a communication, or are they just solely looking at local government relationships?
Through the chair,
Mr. Cheney.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Costello. No, we haven't. Engaged. But if there was an opportunity, it'd be very interesting.
Mm-hmm. To the chair,
Ms. Atkinson.
Yes, as a former city manager for the city of Kotzebue, I can testify that the DCRA does work more through the municipalities than co-ops. I don't know that that's a relationship that has been built, but it might be something that we could explore.
And just one other question.
Do you want to keep going down, Mr. Copeland?
It looks like they all
reinforce that as mayor worked with DCRA all the time, but never on the electrical side.
Mr. Sham as well.
Yeah, not much of that.
Thank you, then, Representative Costello.
Thank you. I was curious, and I'd asked this before, are there regulations that we could be looking at that would make some of your challenges easier without, you know, watering down the intention of the regulation?
Mr. Copeland?
I think there's some paths for state regulation instead of federal regulation. The state departments tend to understand our regions and challenges and opportunities a lot better, a lot more streamlined. And I think there are some regional opportunities for the state to make land selections, especially in Forest Service and BLM, because their permitting processes are much more friendly. And I don't think there's any compromise of the environmental requirements. In fact, it may result in more, I think, focused community conversation, more appropriate, if that's a word. Really get at the key stakeholders and so forth.
Mr. Cheney?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Costello. Absolutely. And thank you for asking that question. Through our fiber project, the route that was depicted on the map, that 80 miles, roughly 80 miles from Leavelock to Dillingham, we are paying the Department of Natural Resources roughly $24,000 in an easement fee for developing a communication network that is a very much needed resource to our state. That cost ends up squarely with every one of our members. It does have an effect on the way we conduct business and the rates that we can recover to pay for those. So if anything, the support from the state in developing these projects and alleviating any of the costs that possible would certainly help immensely in the planning and execution of those projects.
Thank you, Representative Costello. Do you have any follow-ups on that? Thank you very much. Representative Edgman.
Yeah. Welcome, gentlemen. Good to see you again. So PCE, a couple of years ago, we passed legislation to increase the usage rate per residential consumer from 500 to 750 kilowatt hours. And thank you, Mr. Lisak, for letting me know yesterday that that the annual cost of PCE has sort of ballooned to $48 million, if I remember right, the number being. And some of that is attributed to that increase on KWH rate from 500 to 750. But I was wondering, Mr. Copeland, you're the chairman of the Alaska Energy Authority Board. Is that attributed to more widespread use? Is it like 84 communities or something like that that benefit from the PC program? Or is that just the larger communities? You know, there's a lot of smaller communities that don't even get to 500 kilowatt hours, right? They don't have a washing machine or a dryer. Maybe they got a small freezer. A lot of communities that have, you know, more appliances, bigger, you know, stuff. It's just interesting to get your perspective on it. Mr. Copeland, okay. If you know, have any insight into that.
Mr. Copeland.
Yes, thank you, Representative Edgman, through the chair. And I'll be careful how I answer this because there's some AEA answer and there's CEC answer. So I would say as a CEC, as a user of the PCE program, I don't think we've seen an increase in our average residential use. We're holding pretty steady there. So I don't think people are using more. And that average use is about 500 kilowatt hours. So many of our customers don't reach that threshold. I will say from the Cordova Electric perspective, so I'm not just wearing my AEA hat, the AEA has been significantly improving that program. Frankly, it's being administered a lot more carefully now. And that means that they're approving community facility use applications that some were submitted 3 and 4 years ago. Cordova is one of those, and they're now paying those. So I think the program has improved, but there's been a little bit of cost to that because the eligible recipients are actually receiving the full benefit there. Then on the AEA side, and we discussed this just in our strategic planning, there's upward and downward pressures, and we're right at 99% of the eligible funding. So we see there's some upward pressure. If fuel prices rise, then we're probably going to go just a little bit over. But there's some downward pressure in, again, the rail belt floor is rising. So that actually lessens the eligibility of the recipients and takes pressure off. So I would just say that there's upward and downward pressure, but not a lot either direction. And they are just right at the eligible funding, partly because it's been administered better. We have not in Cordova actually seen more kilowatt hours, I think, being because of that change the legislature made. So.
Thank you, Mr. Cheney. I saw you looking like you might want to say something as well.
I through the chair, thank you, Representative Edgman. That is a great question. And maybe it's because we don't have a renewable and we are a 100% diesel. The cost associated with that, the other form of energy, I'll say in diesel, being what it is, we have seen that additional 250 kilowatt hours consumed and I'll say much appreciated from our members. That provided some relief from, and whether it's electric heat we don't get into that to that level, but it has been consumed. It has been used by our members for sure.
Thank you, Mr. Stamm.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Medrum. Similar to Clay, we have not seen an increase in residential or even commercial use with that increase of 750 kilowatt hours. And that is a 50% increase over the 500 kilowatt hours that was there before. So when we talk about a balloon of the PCE cost, I think it's only gone up by 19 or 20% since that has happened. And it is highly dependent on the cost of fuel. So if there is a rise in the increase in fuel, I think that's going to move the needle a little bit more than that threshold for residential consumers. What we do see, I think, is in the wintertime, what we are seeing is that that energy was used before. It was just never reimbursed from PCE. We still see the same average use for residential consumers. But in the wintertime, there have been peaks where when they are also paying for a lot of diesel fuel to heat their homes, they're also using additional electricity, both for light and heat, if they need to supplement. The convenient thing about an electric utility is that we carry the cost for 30 days, and sometimes people need that bridge, and they will turn on their electric stove or turn on their electric heat rather than being able to go down to the store and buy diesel fuel. But I don't think we've seen a drastic increase, but I do appreciate that 750 kilowatt hour peak because it's in the wintertime when that people are most in need and have so many other expenditures that they get a little bit more relief.
Mr. Atkinson?
I would just say similarly, I don't know, we've seen an increase in residential usage, but the economic relief that has been provided by the additional KWs has really helped our community. And, you know, I think that has been very beneficial for our community. So it's greatly appreciated. Hope it stays in place.
Thank you, Representative Benjamin. You have another question?
Well, just a closing comment. It's in statute now, so it would take a bill to change it, and I don't see that happening anytime soon. but the reason I asked the question, I really appreciate the varied responses because, you know, intuitively I can tell you it is tied to fuel just with my experience being out in Dillingham and whatnot. But the last PC report I saw, and it probably comes out later on or maybe the next month or so, the annual PC report from Alaska Energy Authority actually showed about less than 300 kilowatt hours if you average it out through all the communities. Mm-hmm. So, but that increase of 500 to 750 in certain places really has had a very, noticeable benefit to, you know, the community, the consumers, whatever. So thank you for going down that direction. And unfortunately, I have to leave, Madam Co-Chair, and really appreciate your presentations today.
Thank you very much. So we're getting towards our last few minutes here, and I'm sure we can continue for hours, but we will not do that. Do any of our rural utility folks have any concluding comments or final messages you would like to leave with us with today? Mr. Cheney.
Through the chair to the committee, I'd just like to again express my gratitude and I'll say our gratitude in inviting us here. The climate being what it is, there are plenty of challenges. It's something that we're very familiar with in the rurals. We've been dealing with these challenges for a long time. So any assistance, any attention we can get at this level is very much appreciated, and this is one of the partnerships that I mentioned I would like to see us take advantage of in the future if at all possible and as much as possible.
Thank you very much. There's a few points I wanted to make sure that were made today, and they were not only covered by one presenter, but by multiple. So I think that some of the work we've been doing in the committee has brought together some lights, like the benefits of having more than one fuel source, for example, and being able to have diverse communities, energy sources. So any final things before I do my concluding business, Mr. Copeland?
Yes, Co-Chair Mears, I'd just like to thank you and your colleagues for the engagement as you bring new bills forward. vetting them and giving us an opportunity to comment and try to improve those. Your work off session, visiting communities, visiting energy sites, educating yourself, it's it really shows, and I think helps improve the way that we work together. So, and your engagement, this committee and others in the panels yesterday and this morning for the Alaska Power Association here, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate your time. So that concludes our business for today. Next Tuesday, we will have a delayed start of 1:30 p.m. so that we can do, I think that's for a FinSub. We will be hearing, oh, no, it's schedules for our presenters. So congratulations. We've got a half an hour. We can do other things between 1 and 1:30. We'll be hearing from Director Curtis Thayer on House Bill 164, which is annual net metering, if I'm remembering correctly, as well as Representative Ted Eichheit's bill, House Bill 257. We had been talking about amendment deadlines for next week on 259 and 252, so the large energy use load and the electric utility fire prevention plan. At this point, we've been having conversations and we're doing some other work on the bill. So at the moment, no amendment deadlines in the committee. We will find time to take up HJR 27 next week, and we'll see when we can make that happen. But for today, there's no further business in front of the committee. We are adjourned at 3 o'clock p.m. on the dot. Thank you very much.